Okay, the basic objective of the story, so I'm trying to understand a very complicated story in the Chumash, is what I call, descriptively or whatever, this is thematically, the commando raid. The story, well, it seems to be that way. The story of Abraham's raid against a mighty coalition in order to rescue his nephew Lot. And the story makes it clear that Abraham set out with only 318 slaves, and achieved a tremendous, tremendous victory. The whole story is very, very complicated. Very, very complicated, and there's many questions. I think it's something which really doesn't get analyzed that much. And I'm undertaking to analyze it very, very specifically, very closely. But the starting point is that what is our objective in studying the stories about the other? We have a certain objective. And it's based on the idea, I think made the point recently when we did Kedoshim to you, that it's basically it's a principle of the Torah that the mitzvot are a guide to perfection, but in and of themselves, mere performance of the mitzvot, without internalizing and incorporating the philosophy and the values behind them, does not provide perfection. And indeed, that a person, it's possible from the concept of kedoshim, that a person can perform all of the mitzvot in terms of not violating the technical requirements and still be very far removed from perfection. Right? So, where does the Torah provide us with a model? What's the model of what the personality that the Torah is trying to produce? Right? Now that clearly seems to be who? Oh, where do we find that? The others. Of course, they're not just, it's not limited. It's not limited to the others. But the others seem to be, they occupy a special place. That's the paradigm. That's the whole idea, that we identify as children of the others. And from their merit. They are different because, you know, the Chumash always says, it's not because of you, it's only because you're supposed to be the children of the others. So really, the one to achieve perfection, and it's very, very interesting because you would think that in a system like the Torah, the role model should be people that themselves lived up to the Torah, to the, right? Fulfilled the Torah, fulfilled the mitzvah. It's very ironic that the role models are people that existed before the time of the Torah was given. Now, essentially, therefore, did not keep the Torah as we know it. I know that's a controversial issue as to whether the Avos kept Tayyag or not.
Okay.
I'm not even going to get into that issue as to whether they kept it or whether they didn't. You want Chazal to say that, and you take that literally, but clearly the Rambam does not seem to take it literally in his letters and in his formulation and in the Torah. It would seem clear, because he tries to make a point, proof from the Avos, that even righteous Noah Christ, the seven laws have a share in the world to come, and he brings the proof from the Avos. Of course, the Avos kept mitzvahs, and God kept revealing, and that's what Ram describes it, sort of a development up to Sinai. Certain mitzvahs were revealed. Abraham is Mesakim, it's Shachmas, and he shows the whole progression. But it doesn't seem from there that he kept the Tayyag mitzvahs as we know it. And I think that view is very, very complicated. So to many, many questions, because so many of the mitzvahs are continued upon experiences that didn't even happen until. You know, if you want to stretch, you can stretch, but using a rational approach, and it has to make sense, it's very difficult since, as I said, like, all the mitzvahs, it seems, not all, but many of these revolve around the situations that didn't even exist in the time of Abraham. Okay. And yet these individuals are the role models. So you see that clearly from there that the ideal of the Torah is to produce a certain type of a perfected personality. And this is expressed by three different individuals, three great individuals. So therefore, the objective is to try and understand, to come closer to that ideal. It's very difficult. I'm not going to try and find new formulas. I'm not looking for that. As we uncover more information from more stories, we learn more about what, you know, it's very hard to say. I mean, what's the essence of it? Put it into a formula. But we learn more about it. We learn more about what the idea is. Now, another raya for this is, and this is also connected to the Shia, I'd like to elucidate this in a more specific way than we ever elucidated before. We see that the purpose of the avos in terms of the future was to serve as role models. Whenever the Jews did, because they pretty much went through all of the challenges and the crises and the situations that we would go through. And Ramban talks about that. You know, that they prepared the way, so to speak. God set it up. The Ashtapa. Maisa Elohim on the bottom, that's good. It wasn't just that you can learn, sometimes you can learn from a guy's experiences, but his experiences are limited. Now I find myself in a situation that I can't look back. But it seems more than that, that God anticipated all of these situations, more or less. And the others were subjected to just about all the situations. And one, you know, you have to use your intelligence, obviously. That's what Chazal say, that whenever they had an encounter with anti-Semitism, and they had to meet with the Goyim, with the Gentiles, they'd always open up the parasha to the story of Yaakov of Nathan, to learn, to gain insight from that story. So, that is illustrated in the case of Khaled. When the Satan wasn't a Khaled, on the case of the spies, by Shalah, that he was Mishtatach of Kivayeros. So he frustrated himself of Kivayeros, right?
Yes.
Because he too felt a certain attraction to the idea of the Meraglim, and he drew sustenance from Kivayeros. Now I want to show that in a more specific way. As a result of this, I think after we go through this particular area, it'll become clearer to us, not just in a general way. Of course, in a general way, and, you know, the courage and all the greatness of thought, fine. But it may be a more specific way. Okay. Alright, today we're just going to try and get the factual base, the background, which leads into this story. Because you know that that was a great man, but of course he's very much overshadowed by his uncle, Avraham. He's the Gamal Lot, Haholeth as Avraham. Right? Lot traveled with Avraham. He was very wealthy, the prophet said. As you say, he's on the buck of the Aholam. So he too. And Rashi points out that what was the cause? There are two Megaram, two important Rashis over here. What was the cause of Lot's success in his life? So we're in Pasuk Hay, that's Yid Gimel Hay. So it tells us Vagamma Lot. Now it introduces, for the first time, we get a little bit more into the character of Lot. Now you have to understand that Lot was a great man because he joined Avraham in his philosophy, in rejecting the Avodah Zarah, and in leaving his homeland and, you know, embarking on this journey. So Rashi says that who caused it? Midoram. Yes, Rashi says, and a whole race of Avraham. Midoram. What caused him to have this? Halicha Shalom Avram. It was an halicha with Avram. Okay. Now, what takes place is Lo Nasa Osam Ha'aretz L'Shevet Yachzor. And apparently there wasn't enough pasture, you know, grazing area. The land, there wasn't enough land to sustain both of them, because they both had a tremendous amount of wealth and animals, etc. Right? So that's the way the prophet seems to indicate. Because they had great possessions, and they could not live together. Then the prophet Zion says, by his will, Bain Roe Mitne Avram, is Bain Roe Mitne Love. There was a dispute between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Love. And the Kanai and the Frizi were then living in the land. This would appear to be superfluous. Like, what do we need this for? It seems that the cause, in other words, the Torah is providing the cause for the split. And the cause of the split seems to be already incorporated in the Pasuk, which shows you that we both had extremely large amounts of possessions, animals, and so forth, and they didn't have enough land, so they couldn't dwell together. Then it adds that there was a rib. It seems to be like there were two causes. But why do I, you know, what did, why would the Torah three causes to fact? In other words, it seems to be two separate things. Either they split up because there was either one would be sufficient on its own. Well, you have to have both. Right? Either you can tell me that the reason for what was the reason for the separation? Was it because of the rib? Then you don't need the preamble. You know, the other factor that they had too many animals that required feeding. And there wasn't enough pasture, land for pasture. Or you could say that, in other words, that itself would require a separation, or you could say that that didn't require a separation and they separated because of the rib. But once you have the factor, the public is telling you that there was not enough land, there's no need to go further for these extra reasons. The Torah doesn't have to bring out all the reasons. Now, Rashi addresses by his rib. And he says, Lefisha, how you row of Shalot, the Shoyim. Because the shepherds of Lot were the Shoyim, were wicked. And they would allow their animals to graze in other people's fields. But really, Avram, Melchisham, Al Gezel. And the shepherds of Avram would give Yukon about Gezel. The Haim Omen, they would answer. Nitnahar to Avraham. The land was given to Avraham. The law ain't Yorit. And he does not have a Yorit, someone to inherit him. The Lot Benach of Yorsha. And his nephew Lot is therefore his Yorit. The ain't there Gezel. And this is not Gezel. The Akkasim Omer, and the prophet says, the Akkasim Vafrizi of Yorsha Barat. Now he says, according to this midrashic interpretation, it fits in. That's why the prophet is saying, "Lachani v'afizi oziyoshe v'arav." At this point in time, it didn't belong. It was only a promised land, but it was not their land yet. It didn't belong to them. Below zocha ba'avram adayim, and Avram had not taken hold of it as yet. It's interesting. That's a very interesting Rashi in Talmud. See, I would say this is starters. That the two psukim are not really two separate causes, it's really one cause. And the cause is never really just about physical issues. It's not just a matter. Whenever there's a practicality, because practicality, it's just a purely practical problem and it lends itself to the solution. There are ways to work things out. And even if, you see, even if it was physically impossible and that they had to have some type of a separation, but what's taking place is more than just that. You see, that it's not just a physical solution, but the two people are hikarei dameola. It means they're breaking, it's a break in the relationship. It's more than that. It seems if you read this, it's necessary for the pasuk to give these causes, because what emerges is not simply a physical division. Let's say there is not enough room. So then you work it out. That's not what he said. When he said, "By Yom Ravam Alot, I'll not be Mariv of any of them." You see, what caused Avraham to address Lot was the Mariv. But he doesn't address. It seems now that the first state. Well, what do you have to address the Mariv? The first issue, the issue of land, that there's not enough land, wasn't even addressed. In other words, the effect is that Avram addresses, let there not be a rift between us. Alright? So if that is the case, that the parish is telling us about that and how Avram dealt with that, so what do you have to introduce it by saying how much, you know, animals they had and that there wasn't enough land? You see? The two go together. That's obvious. The two go together. That it started off that way. But as a result of this problem, until that point in time, they didn't have such a problem. But then a problem developed, and in the course of that problem, you saw the differences emerge between the followers of Avram and the followers of Lot. The followers. The riv did not break out between Avram and Lot. The riv broke out between the followers. But you have to realize also, there's no doubt that it's a reflection of the leaders. That this is... It's clearly a reflection of Lot and his approach, his philosophy, his ideas. He followed Avram, he was a great man, but he wasn't 100% committed to all of the principles of Avram. There had to be differences. And those differences were expressed in the attitude of the Rosh. Now perhaps you can explain to me what it means. You know, well, what it seems at least to be some type of an intellectual argument. That the Roe Avram is Yisrael. And they didn't just negate them. They didn't say, you know, we'll do it as we please. They seem to be operating with some type of system, with some type of a rationality. Right? Because they weren't saying we're going to, they were saying it's not Gezel. Basically, they were trying to answer that it wasn't Gezel. Because of this idea that he's the Yoresh and so forth. So, you know, how do we interpret that? The question is, why is Rashi bothering to record what they're arguing? Just for Shana. They're just trying their thing. Right? So then the being is, who cares what they say? They must say, the Rashi Rashi must reply to something about it. Otherwise, it would be, you know, they would just, they wouldn't care. They would tell the Roe Avram to mind their own business, you know. But they didn't say that. The thing is that they had some type of an explanation for what they were doing. So that's a different kind of a rishon. Rashi characterizes them as a shayin. True. But he also mentions their argument, and at least on the surface, the argument didn't seem that totally crazy. There's something to it. There's something to it, right? That's like it's interesting psychology. You can relate to this psychology. In other words, you can put yourself in the position of the Roy Love, and you may feel that it's wrong, but you may also be drawn to it as well. It has a certain appeal. Right? It doesn't appeal to you as being outright Gezel. Even though, of course, yeah, you probably put an arc and that, you know, it's one of those things that seem, at least, to, you know, situations where you feel morally it's not such a good thing, but technically I can't do it. It's one of those. That's what it seems to be, am I correct? From a moral standpoint, if you look at it purely from a moral standpoint, you may give some credence to the argument. You may. But, you know, that you can't always look at things purely from the moral. You have to deal with the law, with the way these laws have been established. But sometimes you just have to, refrain from doing certain things that morally might be good, because it doesn't matter, but technically speaking, these are the laws. Assume that these fields that they were grazing in could not have been that important to the people who owned them, because they would have been fighting with them as well. If this wasn't the thought, so you'd probably assume it's just property. Sometimes people own, you know, properties that are out in the field, and that thing is what they're not going to miss it anyway. That type of thing. Yeah, but it's not yours. I would imagine something like Rashi doesn't know into that. Who are the owners? We were the owners. Why did they refuse them and say, we're going to get into trouble for stealing it? You know, we're a minority. So that rebuke wasn't mentioned. Right? Therefore, the only issue then was purely an issue of Gezel. It would seem that that's the case, which shows you the level of the Roe Avraham, that it wasn't a matter of practical concern. Nobody would know. Nobody would care. Because apparently it was far off, you know, from where they actually, from the inhabiting places. The owners of those fields weren't complaining, let's put it this way. So therefore it was a case where they clearly could get away with it. And it boiled down to simply an issue of right and wrong. Alright? You gotta say like this. I think it could be answered very simply, because we can relate to the mindset of the Roe Lobe. We can relate to that mindset. If you look at something like this, why is it that God is going to remove the land from them and give it to us? Is it because we are really superior to these people? Right? That's one thing. That's one attitude. Or no, it has nothing to do with that. It's all part of God. God has a system which he wants to reveal to the world, and we have a role to play, and therefore we have to subordinate ourselves to that system. That was the role of Abraham. See, Abraham didn't feel that he had any special qualities. He didn't feel that he had any special privileges. Even though God promised the land to him, he realized that's only because it fits into the framework of God's system. So that's Kilo Shivay Mavon Hamari Adasa. And at this point in time, they have to live in accordance with the system. The system at this point in time is like absolutely nothing to do with the land. The fact that the land at a future time will become yours does not in any way create any special rights to you right now. Now you're a total stranger. You see, yeah, but Toshua and Alfie Machami, you have to plead with them, you give them a lot of kevah and so forth. But if a person relates to that in a different way, emotionally, so then he allows himself to form an emotional attachment to the entity right now, and therefore negates that. But if you negate them, and you say, then what's the difference? I mean, if they, yeah, so like, that's like you start taking already. Frankly, you see, it's a totally different attitude. It's, these people aren't going to be here anyway. They're gone. They're just, there's a certain negation of the people that live there right now. Because the guy, the person who's relating to it, as though he were God's chosen one. He had a certain superiority. So that's what, this argument is not a rational argument, but it reflects a certain attitude that's haughtiness, a certain haughtiness that they have, and a certain sense of superiority. So they were not perfected people. That's why they're called the Shia. But interestingly enough, this is not attributed to Lot, it's attributed to his realm. So you see, but I would say that there must be some defect in the character of Lot. There must have been some defect, because from the disciples, and it's not just one, it's like it seems to be generally speaking, these were their own, this was the attitude. When you have a certain attitude that prevails amongst the whole group of students or disciples, it usually stems from some defect in the leader. Whether it's the leader's fault or not the leader's fault, but it usually will trace itself back to a certain flaw. And conversely, when you see by Abraham that his Rowan maintained the correct idea, that's attributable to the perfection of Abraham. What was the result? So Abraham concluded that it's not a good idea to have a rib. Apparently he couldn't solve it. You have to assume that. You would have expected that Abraham would kind of work out the problem. Almost in Reva. Let there not be a rib. Okay, fine, so what's the solution? Apparently Abraham felt that there was a you have to understand. You can't always solve a problem. Sometimes you have to be separate. Sometimes separation, you have to deal with reality. And we also have to recognize that even the greatest people like Abraham, doesn't mean that every problem that comes up, they can always work out. He does the same. And finally, he studied the matter, he understood what was happening, and he saw that the best thing to do would be for us to separate. You see the greatness of Abraham. He's called Yamayola is the greatness of Abraham, in my opinion. There's a certain greatness there. What's the greatness? That in spite of the fact that Abraham was totally alone in the world, and he just had one person, Lot was a great man. He left his homeland, it was his nephew, his family, and then he went down to the shrine with him, and he was loyal to him, and so forth. You would have thought that in most cases, emotionally, you might be tempted to compromise the principle. Just the opposite, but in a situation like that, you tend to overlook. It's always the case with friends, with family, whenever you see things that, morally are unacceptable. And you still you have to rebuke, but they won't change. And then you realize that you can't stay together anymore. There's always that emotion. Sometimes very often people compromise their principles because they don't want to lose friends. Now, I would say, pardon Amayola, almost in Riva, pardon Amayola, again shows the greatness of Abraham. That even though he was all alone in the world, he didn't have anyone, and he was someone who was extremely loyal, a relative, a nephew. You think these two people would stick together? When Abraham realized that at this point in time it would be detrimental from the idea of his perfection and the ideas and that it could have a bad effect on his rowing or whatever, so then he separated. He separated. I think quite the contrary, that you see the opposite. Had he been affected in any way by this corruption, then he would not have initiated the separation. He said, oh, stay together, work it out. That's the tendency. Overlook certain things. You work it out. But then he says, "Halo kol aretz lefanecha, yitkored nami ola. Im ha'smol ve'imino, vim ha'yamin ve'asmi ila." Okay, so what does that show you? What does that show you? It shows you that the attitude towards the physical, like the difference between Avram's attitude towards the physical towards materialism and Lot is beginning to emerge over here. But he didn't have any particular attachment to this place or that place. He was very generous. He was Navaka. He was very undemanding when it came to something like this. In other words, it doesn't, whatever you pick, your choice, whatever it is you pick, and I'll go the other way, I'll find. He was very confident that he would not starve, that he would not have any problems. So that's why he said, you know, whatever you pick. Now, what do you see in Pasuk? Vayisa lota zeyav, vayar is kotiki vayarden, so Lot lifted his eyes. I said, the Torah is really revealing things about the person. He lifted his eyes. This is the way it describes it. Yichu al mashke, lefnei shachas al Hashem astami tamar, gan al Hashem kere tzvan baruch atzoa. Now there's something that's problematical in that pasuk. Something very problematical. The pasuk, nobody would write this way. I mean, it's, they say he lifted up his eyes and he saw this beautiful plain. It was well watered, you know, lush. It was verdant. It was lush. It was beautiful. Before God destroyed it. No. Well, that's not just why it's necessary. It's nobody would describe it. Clearly, it's superfluous and it just doesn't make sense. It's quite obvious that what he's seeing is before the destruction. In fact, if you, the book is going to, that's the point, the story is going to tell you that it became, you know, about the destruction. If you're writing a book that way, right, in which a person comes into a place and sees because of the beauty and so on and so forth, then after a few years it becomes destroyed by an atom bomb. So we all know that when he saw it at first, it was before the explosion, obviously. Right? Why mention that? Because Nei Shachas al Hashem is clearly superfluous, in a, not just superfluous that it's not necessary, but in a negative kind of a way. From a literary standpoint, it doesn't make any sense to say that. Clearly it's a criticism of love. I mean, it shows by Yisrael Lo Tateno that he was really carried away by his by what he saw.
It's like prostitution of God.
Yeah. That's it's a tremendous Mutter Haskam. Most people, that's the way they live their lives. Lo Tatu Rachare Levavchem V'Yachrei Nechem. That the people are tremendously affected by the sensual, and they can't go beyond that. And clearly, this is, I mean, it wasn't only the Shabbos that it came. That's one thing, to take into consideration all the factors. Maybe it was very attractive from a materialistic point of view, but it was a corrupt society. And that can't be good. You have to take all these factors into consideration. But you see, not just that, even before that, he winds up being a captive. That means that another criticism. Maybe a country has tremendous economic potential, but if you look into their politics, you can see how crazy they're acting, and they can be conquered in 6 months, and you lose everything. So if Nei Shachas al Hashem is a modification of the choice, it shows you another element about love, that he chose on the basis of the sensual attraction without really looking into it. Nei Shachas al Hashem is basically a society which is on the verge of being destroyed. And if that is the case, and God's marah af, God is, so to speak, long-suffering, that means that he did not look into any of the other factors, the corruption from within, or he simply ignored it. He didn't care about it. It wasn't a factor. He didn't factor it into his decision. That's what Nei Shachas al Hashem. He did not factor all those elements into his decision-making process. Okay, he says, Vayivchal Lot is called Kikar Yardin, and Lot chose the entire plain of the Jordan. And he traveled from the east. It's more than just he traveled. It's one thing to travel, but it was more than that. Apparently, there was a separation. Ishmael, they separated. It seems that there was a break in the relationship. Since the Torah is making, he parted Namayalai, right? Vayipardu seems to be more than just an absence of being together. It seems to be a positive separation of the ways. We're not together anymore. You're following your own movement. You have your concept. I have mine. We're not the same. We're not together anymore. Even when they were together, I don't think they were living in the same tent, because they had a lot of people. So they could have been living a few miles from each other. It doesn't mean that, you know what I mean, that they spent time every day. But they were still together. This indicates to me a separation. They're two separate entities at this point in time. The matter is, that's probably why he gave him that offer. He was intent upon it. He wanted to make sure that there would be a separation. So that's why he made it attractive. You pick. Since I'm the one that's initiating the idea, I'm not going to, and I'm not doing it because I want, that's another thing. Sometimes the person will suspect that you're initiating the separation because you're going to cheat, because you have your eye on something. Exactly, exactly. When a person comes up and says, let's split, we have a business together. He says, I want to split. And he decides how the split should be, so you're always going to be suspicious. And then maybe he's splitting for materialistic reasons. Apparently, Avram wants to communicate to him in the split that the reason that he's doing it is because of philosophical reasons. That's good, but perhaps Lot will think it over. And he asks himself the question, why did Avram split with me? And in doing so, he didn't want him to ever think, well, yeah, because he picked that land. That's why he split, not to see. In other words, I would say that when Avram split with Lot for philosophical reasons, he wanted Lot to have the opportunity to think it over and to make corrections, to be true, and so forth. Therefore, he did it in such a way to make it clear that he's not doing it for any materialistic gain. And he gave him the children. And he never done that. But he engaged in any other way of doing the chalukah. Even if he said, we'll work it out together, then there'd always be the danger that if Lot is not satisfied with his portion, he could say, oh, I've not engineered it because it's materialistic reason. So therefore, he did not get involved in that at all. You pick whatever you want. Whatever you pick, I'll take what's left. What does it mean? If they're right, I'll take the left. It doesn't mean literally, I'll take the left. It just means that whatever it is available, I'll have second choice. You have first choice, I'll have second choice. So therefore, Lot, when he would think over the issue, would never be able to excuse Avraham of having any ulterior purpose. And why does it say, when he says, the name of the Anoshim Acham Anachim? What does he have to mention? Because they're brothers. What's the point of that? Well, it says means that we should not allow this to destroy the entire relationship. He didn't want to. He was a brother. I mean, he was a family close, and he didn't want to destroy the relationship. That's what he was saying. He didn't want to reject them as a person, because sometimes people go all the way, it's all or nothing. If they separate, they split up, so in their own minds, he says, oh, that's it. They obliterate the whole relationship. But he says, I value you as a person. I still value him, respect him, as we see. I mean, he came to rescue him. Kemeshem Acham Anachnu is very important. We shouldn't just throw this out the window. You know, that's an important thing. Brothers, or family, or stuff, etc. But it turns out that sometimes the only way in which it can be maintained is through a separation. You have to go separation away. Kemeshem Acham Anachnu. That's what he mentions that. He didn't go to that extreme, that if he's not, that's the way the average person thinks. Because everybody, most of their relationships, their whole lives with those others revolves around themselves. One person is close to me and I like him, and then he has value. But if a split should occur and he separates, then it's like he doesn't exist in my mind. He has no value. It's sort of negates. It's like a negation of the other person. I don't negate him. I'm not sure, I'm not sure they're brothers. I still value these brothers. And so forth. But this is what's best in terms of the situation. It's best that we now go our separate ways. And he says right away in Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, the Anshei Shalom, Rayim V'Chatan, Rayim V'Chatan, Rayim V'Chatan. Once again, that confirms that the place that Avram was really right. But there was a need for separation, because there's something wrong. Now Lot had deviated from the philosophy that he'd allow himself to live in a place like Sodom where the people were wicked, just because it was beneficial to him materialistically. It shows a certain distortion in his philosophy. Now, the next part about the revelation of God to Avram at this point, and what he promises, I'm going to skip over that for time then. Okay? I don't know that it's really necessary to my purpose. Let's go from here. We go to Vayihi Ben Rachel, Perek Yudalet. Now that seems to be over there. The Chumash is introducing us to the story of Avraham's rescue, but it does so by giving us background material. Now, what strikes you as strange when you start to read this? It seems to me that there's an excessive amount of detail. The Torah, really, all we need to know is that what? Is that Lot was captured? They captured, and to do so, The Torah usually omits a tremendous amount of descriptions. A lot of descriptions. We have to go back into the whole background of the fields, the four kings and the five kings, and then they made agreements and they served them, and then they rebelled, and the 13 years they rebelled, and the 14th year they decided to come against them. When they came against them, they didn't come directly against them, if I'm not mistaken. Correct? First day, when they came against them,
they wiped out
all the surrounding nations, to the fire and so on and so forth, even though they were not involved in the dispute itself. Then they turned their attention on Saddam. Essentially, Saddam seems to be the most important of the four of the five, the coalition of the five against the four, and the four mightiest. Then it describes the destruction, as they fell into these pits, and the remainder ran into the mountains. And then they made off with all of the people and all of their wealth. And they also captured Lot. You know, a lot of description takes place. It seems that the entire purpose of telling us this is simply that we should know that Lot was captured to pave the way for introducing us to the deed of Abraham. This seems to me, in general, like it's too much description. Unnecessary. What do we learn from all this? It's just unnecessary. That is true. Rashi doesn't make that point. That it's describing for you how powerful before the coalition of the four was. In spite of all these conquests and power, they toppled the coalition of the five. Still, Abram did not restrain himself. Did not refrain from attacking them. That's true. That is true. But it gives a lot of specifics. It's still not necessary. It's still not necessary. You can make that point. That doesn't account. That is important. And some background is needed to give us a sense of how powerful they were. But still, it doesn't account for all of the details. Yeah, everything's falling out. A lot of detail. I would like to try and account for that. Okay, let's pick up, continuing the story of Abraham and his rescue mission to save his nephew Lot. Let's pick up with the question of what motivated Abraham to do this. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't ask that question if Lot needed help in a different type of a way, financially or whatever the case may be. So it's obvious, it'd be self-evident why Abraham would want to help him, he's his nephew and so on and so forth. But we were asking about an action in which he put himself in all these people that came under risk. And something which is astounding to us, because what's missing from the story, the main element that's missing, is it just seems partly implausible. How would he be able to do it? But the Torah does not omit the fact. The way the Torah presents it seems like an impossible mission. It seems like an impossible mission. Because, as the Rashi mentioned, it goes to a great length to describe the power of the coalition of the four, how they defeated the five, and then how they subjugated them, and when they rebelled against them, they decided to put a complete end to these kingdoms, and they in fact defeated all of the surrounding nations that might come to help them, and then they moved directly against them, and they wiped them out completely and carried off all of the Rechush. So the Torah is going through lengths to describe the excessive strength and power of the four. So it certainly bothers the mind that Abraham Avinu, who we have not been told at any point that he was a warrior, would take 318 of his men, it's not even his men, it's just his servants, the Levi Beto, who had grown up in his house, and the 318 kids go out and, you know, wage this war and pull off this tremendous victory. It just bothers the mind. Again, to bolster this point, if you do maintain that Abraham did have this tremendous military capacity, then we don't understand why he was passive when he went to Mitzrayim and allowed Sarah to be taken. And yet there he had to make up a lie that he was her brother. And after this event occurs, he has the same situation with God's Abi Melech, and yet he doesn't want to raise. So it seems clear, I mean, we take it for granted without questioning that he had to do that because he had no power. So he just accepted the inevitable. Yet here we see them acting in an entirely different way. And we're not prepared for this, because where does Where does the Chumash point out to us that he had military expertise, that he was a warrior? So why did he do it? Why did he do it is a very big kind of question. That's why it's a very big, very fundamental story with regard to issues of faith and Judaism, you know, where faith plays a role. And I think that if you don't learn this story properly, you can walk away with a false idea. And that is to say, you can say that Abraham, in spite of the tremendous odds, went out there because he was very faith in God. Now, let's say a person would say that. I mean, again, on the surface it seems impossible, it's impossible. I think we have a question, because we somehow put these people in a different plane. When you're out of them, you do these things. When God's on your side, you win. But there's a very huge problem with that. So first of all, we may think that Abraham, you have to live by the same rules that we have to live by, correct? Yeah, but you see, also if you can maintain that Abraham operates by different rules, not the same rules, which would be very difficult even if you're going to that. The point is, you're going to say you live by different rules, and then, so what's the point of study? What are we going to get out of it? We want to know the rules that we have to operate by. Yeah, but if that's the case, why didn't we do the same thing with regard to Sarah in the trial? You see that if he is awesome. This thing that he's operating by the law of nature, right? It's not defined nature. So then you got to ask yourself, are we obliged to be obedient to nature and worship God in that framework? Or may we define nature on the basis of some type of a faith in God, that God really rescues us from nature and we don't really have to deal with nature because faith becomes so powerful? That's the question one has to ask. Now, a superficial reading of the story would give you that indication. I think that's where a lot of these ideas come from. The true greatness is faith. That we can't do this because we don't have enough faith. But if you only had enough faith, then you could do anything. Of course, and that's not the halacha. Because there is an obligation to Rosam and Obamayef to come to the rescue of their fellow Jew when he's in danger. But the obligation, again, if someone is drowning, and you don't know how to swim, are you obligated to jump into the water? And you have faith in God. You're doing the will of God. Well, if you have to shower, what would the answer be? Absolutely not. So just drown and free God. Now, it is, of course, possible we do maintain the possibility that God will rescue you, but if you are not allowed to assume that, that will be some from our name. So basically, then you're doing suicide. Now, if you do have the ability to swim, then you have an obligation. So therefore, the obligation really is to say the other person's dependence upon your expenses. Say, you're a doctor, then you have to stop and administer help. If you don't know medicine, then let me call a doctor. You can't call a doctor, you can't. If someone's captured by an army, you have an obligation to try and save them, but I'll just run in to the fortress, and I'll charge the fortress, and I'll save him, and we just kill him. So clearly we maintain that you have to operate within the framework of reality. So what's going on over here? That's why this story becomes mind-boggling. It becomes, when you analyze it this way, how do you get through a story like this? What's he doing, Abraham? In other words, we all agree that on the surface anyway, there's a huge problem over here, because from the way Chumash makes it clear, it seems that from a purely rational standpoint, there was no basis for Abraham to pursue this, to continue, to embark on this thing. What he was undertaking was something which seems to go contrary to the laws of nature. Now, a similar case, by the way, a similar situation where you see from Tanakh that one does not engage in activities where clearly you don't have a chance. I mean, of course, I'm not talking about there are times when you don't have a chance, when you have no choice. For example, if you're being attacked and being destroyed, you may say, I'd rather go down and fight it. That's a different, like in the Holocaust, and war for a ghetto. The decision that they made was different because they had two choices. Either be locked up at the concentration camp or fight to the end heroically. So that's different. That was rational to choose to fight heroically and kill as many Germans as you can. And then make a statement that the Jews didn't go to the slaughter like sheep. That's different. You see? Because there was no other alternative. They saw certain death on the other side, so it was a choice between two deaths. That's a different issue. Or where we say that a person is obligated to give his life up to the Hashem. Again, that's a different issue. Here, where was the obligation? The obligation was one of saving one's brother, one's nephew. This is an obligation, but an obligation which you're not demanded to just sacrifice your own life, and certainly the lives of these servants of his, to just put them up on the chopping block. And then miraculously you win. Yeah, but the fact that you can explain what you see, he was right because he won. Right? We don't even look at the view. A lot of times people will do, you can't use that as a proof. A lot of times people will do crazy things. And it's a thief.
Well,
it's even worse when it's a thief because people learn their own lessons. A good general, you'll have that in the military often. A lot of times the soldier will disobey orders, will do something which is militarily crazy, and it can happen, these things win. Then it becomes a new hero, but the general will be very concerned about it. Yes, you want to be fine, but the principle that's being established is that you can do crazy things, you know, they're very careful about that. The case in point is the case of David Hanalach against Goliath. I remember discussing this with Gary Chase. But you see that there was a standoff. I mean, today, Goliath came out in the morning and he was doing the blessing in the name of God, right? You remember the whole thing. He challenged the whole Jewish country to send somebody out and fight against him. And nobody went out to fight against him. Why not? Were they all cowards? They didn't have the courage? You see, Yonatan risked his life in battle. So Gary Chase made a point. He needed to say that there was nobody to show, even though a mighty warrior. They wouldn't be most in effort, they were afraid. And only David had the courage. He said, no, it's because they didn't, according to their own understanding, they were sufficient, and then the whole camp would be destroyed. Not that they were lacking in courage, that they wouldn't give up their lives to follow the trail, but they, according to the way they understood it, they did beaten. And David and Noah had to convince Saul that he had the capacity to win. You see that he did. He spoke to him, he told him what he did, how quite confidence in David that there was a chance. If you read the story carefully, you'll see that at first he was reluctant. Why should I let him go? But why not? Why not let him go? If the only issue was the faith issue, I guess I'm not pointing along. If the only issue was the faith issue, that a person who has so much faith in God that he's willing to go out there and fight against the mighty warrior, so then David certainly meets that test. And if faith is the main thing, then the less military ability you have, the better you are, because then you can go out and so he certainly should have let David go. Why was Shaw reluctant to let David go? Because he has to use his faith. You don't know what God's going to intervene or not, except when you have a specific message from God. I mean, who
does look like Vito?
The main problem that we have with this is that we don't have any insight as to what motivated Avraham. But before we go into that question, and that is to say, was Avraham operating in line with the forces of nature, reality, or was he in defiance of that? And there's no mention that he had a specific prophecy from God. Let's take up the question of what was his motivation. In other words, why? Why did he embark on this mission? The first question I want to address is, let's forget about whether he had the capacity or whether he had at least a chance, a fighting chance. But why was it necessary for him to undertake the adventure at all? It certainly was a risk under the best of circumstances. So I think the answer is to be found, at least one of we can answer one of our questions. It seems that there's a redundancy over here. Because it says, but you have a poet, that's in Perikei Dalet, you give up, but you have a poet, and he survived it. Chazal said it's Oz Malach HaBashan, king, and he told Avraham Ivri, and he was living in Eilone, the plains of Mamre, Hamori, the brother of Eshkol, the brother of Anir, and they were in the members of a pact. Apparently, Avraham had worked up some type of a treaty with them or a pact or an agreement with them. Okay, I don't know if it's an interesting fucker why I have to mention that at this point. But Pasuk Yudal, and Avram heard that his brother was captured, and he armed his disciples, his youth, those who had been born into his house, 318, and chased them to death. Now there's a redundancy, because it's clear when it tells you that he told Avram Ivri, it's quite clear to us that Avram heard. Pasuk does not mention that he heard. So clearly, by Yishma Avram Ki Yishba Atir, he's telling you something very important. Okay. Any thoughts on this?
Well,
clearly, what does the word by Yishma mean? Yeah. The word Shema, like Shema Yisrael, Shema doesn't only mean to hear. Because there is a halacha, Shema b'chalosh m'shat ha-shamayim. That you can recite the Shema in any language that you understand. Of course, the essence is really the idea, it's understanding. You know, very Shema ben Achetam, Yishpat ben Tzedek. That the judges are told to listen amongst your brothers, listen to both sides, and then, you know, judge with justice. So that listening is more than just hearing. So what is it telling you? By Yishma Avram, Avram heard, he nishba achet. That is the reason. If it were not for that factor, then he probably would not have done anything. You can't assume that he would have done this simply to rescue the people of Sodom. But achet is the factor. Achet over here doesn't mean, you know, biologically. They weren't brothers. Literally, they weren't, but there's a term they can. He was his nephew. And I would say that it includes a few ideas. Okay. First of all, in my opinion, the fact that he was captured would constitute a severe problem for what Avram was trying to do. In other words, in a sense, it would be a chilul Hashem. But a de facto, there's a de facto chilul Hashem, and there's an overt chilul Hashem. There's a chilul Hashem where a person acts in a certain way, which brings disgrace to God. But then actually there are certain circumstances which have that effect. For example, the fact that the Jews are in exile, that the Jews are downtrodden, the Jews are persecuted. That itself creates a chilul Hashem. Purely because of how people perceive it. And even though we said that you can't judge, you can't use this barometer. A person is successful in life, you know, you can't say, oh, he's a good person. A person is suffering, you can't say he's a bad. You can't use that barometer because we don't have any, you kind of know. But I mean, but people look very often, that's the way people do look at the situation. So that people look at it when the Jews are victorious politically and militarily, to them that we must be doing something right. When the Jews are defeated, so then we must be doing something wrong. Now, in this situation, Lot shared the philosophy of Avram. Yeah, Lot was his nephew, and he left together with him. He embarked on a journey with him. That's important. You have to know what you're talking about. Lot was a great individual. You see that in the story. He's in the background until now. But obviously, if he left, why would he leave? He did the same thing Avram did. He followed and clung to Avram. Had to be because he believed in his ideas. If he was an ordinary idolater, why would he want to leave his home, his family, his security, and embark on this journey? And why would Avram take him with him? Clearly, up until this point where they had that rift, there was a dispute that broke out between them. You see? But even in that rift, according to Rashi, the ideological dispute by Gezel, you do see an affinity, because the fact of the matter is, from what they argued, you could see that they accepted the premises, that Avram would inherit the land and so on and so forth. I mean, they did accept the prohibition against it, but there was a distortion in their thinking. So now, the fact of the matter is that people, Asher means his brother, that people associated the movement with love. See, the world was watching. Whenever there's a new movement, especially in religion, everybody uses this. People are watching, will it succeed or won't it succeed? So if somebody's captured and they jeopardize their lives, it diminishes the entire thing.
Mm-hmm. He's a major player.
Right?
Lot was a major player.
Yeah, Lot was a major figure, of course. Everybody knew that he left, he was the brother of Avram. To the extent that Avram was known, he was known, because he was his brother. So, look what happens to a person who follows this religion of Avram, this way of thinking. Also, I would say that there's the personal, there's the subjective. In terms of the obligation of chesed, you have a greater obligation of chesed to someone who is your brother than to a stranger. Even though you have an obligation towards all people, and Avram certainly did, but the fact is, he was his brother. He left the land and traveled with him, he went down to Mitzrayim with him, he was loyal to him in Mitzrayim. That's a source of support. So therefore, that's another factor. That's the subjective. There's the objective factor of how the world would look at it. Then there's the subjective factor that a brother has an obligation to a brother. By the way, that also ties into how the world would perceive it. Although I'm not saying everything he did was because of the world would perceive it, but still, that shows the perfection of Avram from the standpoint of his relations to other people, that he's loyal to them. Also, I would say, I think it's a true idea, that in this basically we're talking over here about Pinyon and Shlia, so he's redeeming the captive. I don't get the sense that he was in danger of being killed, well, but that was the factor. You could say that, you can make the case, but I think simply all it's telling you is that he nished Barakov, that he was captive. Which means that he has to live his life as a captive. There's no indication here that they were about to be killed.
Okay,
thinking the over here that with regard to the mitzvah of Pidyon and Shvuyim, it makes sense. I'm not talking halachic right now. But let's just talk in terms of philosophically. That while they say that there's an obligation to rescue any fellow Jew, let's say, but certainly there's a difference between an ordinary person who is not really involved in ideas and knowledge and learning, and it's a great power of heaven. Clearly, a greater evil. You see, the extent of evil depends upon the level of the person. An ordinary person that's not really doing it, just living an instinctual life, if he happens to be in prison, is not, from a philosophical standpoint, not such a great tragedy. I'm not talking about from the human suffering standpoint. I'm talking about from the objective standpoint. Because the person wouldn't be using his time productively anyway. Okay, that doesn't mean we wouldn't have to try and save him. That's not because that's not a question. Yeah, but if a Talmud Chacham, right, if a Gadol is in jail, that's tragedy. You see, it's tragedy because he's really being enslaved, but in the sense that he's being prevented from being involved in the good and learning and teaching and so forth. So there's a greater obligation to free such a person. I'm saying that's why Lot is different than the other people. The other people, basically, there was no terrible tragedy in their being captive. And to a certain extent, they may have gotten what they deserved. The way they conducted themselves. But they weren't living a direct life anyway. They were wicked people. So if wicked people get into trouble, it's even better for the world if they're captive. But Lot was a righteous individual. See, that's another thing, that Abraham, in spite of the fact that there were differences, here's a very good illustration. How Abraham related to someone, even though they had differences. But he's part of it. It's interesting. He did separate. It's another aspect of the story. Because Abraham realized that there was a serious ideological difference underneath the Meriva. And his resolution was, let's separate. All of us in Meriva, let's separate. Now we can still be brothers in separation. But we can't be together anymore because we don't share the same ideology. Okay, but in spite of that, he didn't push him out of his mind, as many, many people would. That's very tough. You're not with me anyway, you're with me or against me. You're not part of the movie, that's it. He still related to him like a brother. Because Abraham related to people on an objective plane. And even though he did not accept his philosophy anymore in its entirety, he still recognized that he was a good individual. In terms of the fundamentals, he had not renounced the fundamentals. He was not a Russian. Just because he separated himself. You see a lot from this. Lot is a very, very interesting character to study. Very hard to study because, you see, again, the Torah leaves it vague. You see, Avram is mounting this rage for the sake of his brother. And also, the Torah points out how different he was than some, because in that story with the guest. Now he goes to the extent to which he went to protect them and to offer hospitality. Where did he get that from? He takes chesed to an unbelievable level. So he definitely had very good qualities. And you say that he was saved from Sodom because of his righteousness. Alright, so Chazal says Chos Avraham, but you have to understand what Chos Avraham means. You can't just say that a guy who told Russia just happens to be his nephew, so he says. That's not the way I understand it. But there's a lot of ambivalence about, you know, because I'm the health story with him and his daughters, right? So to get a total picture is a separate issue, a separate study of exactly what he was like, what his nature was like. We're not doing that right now. That's not our concern. Because we're more concerned with how Avraham operated in this situation. Now, things like this. So we understand now the motivation. Certainly this is a matter of great importance to Avraham. Look what the poet understood it. Avraham is it. He understood it. So he certainly had a desire to save love. But my question is, was the action that he undertook, was it a purely voluntary one, given the fact that it seems to have been so completely almost in the realm of like the hopeless, the chances of succeeding seem to be minute? Or was it mandatory, something which he really had a fear to do? So let's forget, we're not talking halachically now, we're talking from a philosophical standpoint. Would you characterize the reaction, was it a voluntary thing? Didn't have to do it, but you just felt you would do it? Or was it for you? How would you resolve it? What we're looking at, what seems to be this case, what we're looking at is what we have recent history, the coalition, same term. Well, you know, the Western powers that went to war with the Iraq when they took over Kuwait, New Oil, whatever. So you have this is possibly the mightiest combination of them in all of history. You've got all the world's powers. You have at that point in time, the only true superpower of the United States. Then you have the European powers. Even Russia is not either fought or certainly not opposed. You have the greatest combination of power ever assembled against Iran. One country which, it turns out, is basically about 50 years behind, so to speak. Right? It's just sort of a third world type of a military establishment compared to what's being arrayed against them. And you wonder about the insanity of people. You see how insane people can get. That's probably the same insanity which afflicted the king of Saddam when they decided to rebel against the coalition of the four. Now let's assume that Lot had been living in Iraq to make it more real. And the message of his captors, let's assume that they had taken all the, decided to put an end to Iraq, which is basically what they did in the story over here. They decided to put an end to Saddam and all the countries. That they took everything away. Now, let's say that Lot was captured, and they come to Avraham and they tell him that the coalition has captured Lot. Would it make sense to undertake, even if no matter how bad that may be, would it make sense to undertake a suicide mission? Wouldn't you call that a suicide mission? Here, Iraq, which had an army, I mean, relatively, you know, speaking, before they were a major force in the Middle East, a local, a regional power, with airplanes and missiles and so forth, and they were completely destroyed. So how are you going to do anything against them? It would be a suicide mission. So the question is, are we talking over here about a suicide mission? Well, don't you run the risk, if you're concerned that Lot is captured, don't you run the risk that you'll get killed and then the whole thing will be destroyed completely? See, it's even worse. Believe it the way it is, and at least the movement survives. That becomes a huge problem. What right does Avraham have to act in a way which seems to be suicidal? Is it not suicidal? And then the question is that what Judaism teaches, that when faith is strong enough, we can do the suicidal? This is very important. So I'm saying, if you don't learn the story properly, you're going to learn it improperly, because one way or another, there's a lesson to be learned over here. Is the Torah now presenting a new dimension of Avraham? That is to say that he, because of his great faith, he undertakes the suicidal? You don't see this type of thing in the results, even in this regard to the others. Contrarily, you see by Yaakov, when he has to confront Esav, he does everything possible. He placates. Alright, he does divide the camps, but only as a last resort. As a last resort, if he has to, but he certainly doesn't want to go to war, and he certainly is doing everything possible to avoid the war. So, that seems to be the governing principle. I would have thought, if you had anything like this,
getting back to the question, the bottom, the underlying question, whether Avraham is obliged to do this or he simply wanted to do it voluntarily. If we assume that there was some type of a Kiddush Hashem factor to in his in rescuing world, okay, there was a Kiddush Hashem factor in his being captured.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'd say that Avraham had an obligation only if there was a reasonable possibility for success. In other words, if you have a reasonable possibility, you've got a plan that makes sense, that can work, because then of course you're obligated. But if you have absolutely no possibility that you can see, I mean, when I say possibility, I mean in terms of what you can see, and all you can see is just suicide. In other words, that if you win, it would be sort of like a lottery. A lottery is not a rational thing. Right, so a person will buy a couple of tickets for a couple of bucks because you're not paying that. Nobody would put his life on the lottery. You do that, that's Russian roulette. I mean, no, it's even worse than Russian roulette. I mean, you see? Now, nobody would put his life on the line if it wasn't a couple of bucks but your life. I mean, for the lottery. You see? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wait. It seems like he's throwing his life away, hoping that someone. Now, I maintain, I'm going to try and show from the speaking that Avraham, of course, is manifesting faith, but it's a totally different kind of faith, and that he was operating with a plan. And I will try and uncover to you what the plan was to the best of my ability and stay on the speaking. And it's not to say it didn't require daring and power, of course it did. But let me give you an example of what I mean. To set the stage, and you think about it. But of course, you can't just stop speculating. So what you do, obviously, before you just like maybe this to your face, to speculate, you got to sort of like the Chumash does indicate to us. That's why there's a lot of lengthy description. The Chumash does indicate, and I'll try and bring it out. I think a good analogy, and what even from a practical standpoint, would be similar to the situation. We do have similarities. Yeah, after all, Masayel is similar to Bunim. Would be historical, from a historical perspective. Can you think of any situation which is a little bit analogous to what I've been saying in recent history? The situation I'm telling you, where, to all intents and purposes, it appears, it wasn't only Israelis, it was a French airline, which was hijacked by the Palestinian terrorists, brought to Uganda, and for all intents and purposes, it would appear to be like a hopeless task because they had them all. I mean, they could go in there and kill the terrorists, that wasn't the issue, but to get the hostages out alive would be the thing. And that was their concern. They weren't concerned about the attacking force because they're much more powerful, isn't it? But when they were negotiating, with the terrorists, so there were individuals, obviously, there's always differences of opinion. So the defense minister's position was we should never go into terrorism and we should go in and try and launch a raid to rescue them. But the answer, the minister of defense said, we'll come up with a plan. So they submitted plans and they reviewed that these plans don't work. You see? So in other words, their decision as to whether they're going to deal with it politically and even, give in the demand was based, is there a military option? Now when you say a military option, it doesn't mean no plan in the world is guaranteed success. An option means a plan with a reasonable degree of success that military people would rely on. Hopefully. So, in other words, if things work out the way they ought to, and we get some good breaks, we have a good chance of winning. So they kept working, until they came with the plan. Ah, this is the plan. So before that, we had no option. There was no military option. Then they had to review it and perfect it, and then they had to make the decision, what's the best way to go. And they went ahead with the decision, and it turned out to be, a tremendous victory. Now, I am maintaining that Avraham did not embark upon this thing until he had a plan. He was working with a plan. It wasn't like a wild suicide thing. So he had a concrete plan. And if he didn't have a plan at all, he would not have done it. But I will try and show you why, if you read it very carefully, we can sort of see what that plan was. I mean, I worked it out of my time, found one of the commentaries that actually will, you know, learn that. We'll see. So that's our task, is to try and elucidate the plan. And when you see that, again, we'll try and, you know, resolve this issue as to whether it still requires faith. I'm not saying it didn't require faith. You see, there's different situations. There's certain situations that don't really require faith. You see, then there are situations which really faith, where there's absolutely no possibility whatsoever. Then there are those situations where there's a plan, but even so, the plan in and of itself may require a certain amount of faith as well. I'll try to understand that. That's easy. He's working with Chachma. He had a plan. He knew what he was doing. It's not like one of these crazy things where you just couldn't do anything and you know, and everything just worked out magically. So to continue, we said yesterday that the motivation for Abraham to embark on the rescue mission was Ki Nishba Ochid. That Lot was someone who shared his philosophy, way of life, and he was like a brother to him. So I said it has meaning on different levels. First of all, the world identifies him with Abraham. But to a large extent, people will say that it'll cast doubts about the movement, to see if there's a failure of the movement. That he was captured, even though he had the courage and everything in the face to leave his homeland and so forth, nevertheless, what did he get to? He wound up being captured like anybody else. Secondly, there's an obligation upon Abraham, because he's his brother. So there's a greater obligation upon someone, the closer you are to him. And then I said, he was still up there, he was still a high-level individual. And there's a greater evil in a high-level individual being in captivity than an ordinary person. So that was the motivation. But then the question arose, practically speaking, how can you do it? Just because you have an obligation to do something, you have to consider whether you have a possibility. And it's something that we don't maintain that a person should violate the laws of nature. Should embark on crazy actions and just have blind faith that ain't so from Hanes. So you see that the person has to take into consideration the objective factors, and if you look at the objective factors, it seems impossible. How do we understand that Avram, with only 318 men, could take on this mighty coalition of four kings, who the Torah goes out of its way to describe how powerful they were? So that was our problem. And so we said if indeed he had an option, he had a plan that could work, they had a really good chance of success, so then he would be obligated. But if there's nothing you can do, so you don't do anything. Well, why should he not just in danger, but actually, you know, recklessly put everybody in the path of almost certain death? So that's just the question I was asking. And if you maintain that he does not have to have a plan, that whenever it comes to doing something noble, you could just jump into the fire, so to speak, then why didn't he risk his life when Sarah was taken by both Pharaoh and Abimelech? I made that point. So you see that Abraham didn't feel that he had any special right to violate the rules of nature. So let's see if we could develop something, if we could find from the Pesukim what's going on here, some hint as to what's going on. Now, in Perek Yud Dalet goes to great lengths to describe all the background, when really it's not that essential, because all we need to know is that Lot was captured. So what took place over here? It seems that there was a clash between this coalition of the five kings, which Saddam was part of that, against the four, and the four was victorious. Okay? Now, after the first victory, they got together in Emek Hasidim, right, by the Yamamelech, and they made an agreement. Those were like a treaty. What was the treaty? The treaty was that they would pay them a certain tax, a certain type of a servitude, right? Because it says that for staying masturbation on Abduah Sidaloma, they served Sidaloma. So it seems that was the idea, that they didn't destroy these countries,
but rather they allowed them to continue, and they had to accept their whatever the burden was, compensation, whatever indemnities, whatever it was. Then, however, they rebelled. Right? So in the 13th year they rebelled. Now, it's not, I think most of them are first in Pasuk A, it says in the 14th year Kedar Omer and the kings that were in Cain. Now, it's not clear, does it mean what 14th year? Does it mean that they served them for 12 years? And now, Ushlosh Esrei Shana Marado, does that mean in the 13th year? In the 13th year they rebelled? And then in the 14th year, starting from the, you know, the beginning of the count. In other words, you only have 14 years, 12 years of service, 1 year, that's the 13th year of rebellion, and the 14th year is when they came to Christ. That's not how most of them are first learn. They learn it like this, that 12 years they served them, right? In the 13th year, they rebelled, and they rebelled. So how, and then in the 14th year of the rebellion, they rebelled for 13 years, right? So they 25 years, 12 years of service, 13 years of rebellion, and in the 14th year of the rebellion, they came. That's how most of the Farshim learn, although you can learn the other way, you can learn the other way. For my purposes, it helps, it doesn't make that much difference one way or the other, as far as what I'm going to bring out, but it helps a little bit, makes it a little bit clearer to me, to learn that they actually rebelled for 14 years. Let's learn that way. What happened, what was the, after they decided to get together and do something about it, what was their decision? You see from the Pesukim what decision they made, which would indicate that they tolerated. See, why did they tolerate it for so long, if that's the case? Because I would say that you see from history, from contemporary cases, that, you know, after nations go to war and they're victorious and so on and so forth, there's a certain inertia, like they come to demobilization, or they demobilize, they want to get back into a peacetime footing, and see, it's a coalition. Coalitions have certain, you know, built-in problems. Every coalition has a problem. To get together different nations, to coordinate, and so on and so forth, it's not that easy a thing.
They're distant, too.
They're distant from each other, and there's always this question. I would assume, I mean, you could take examples from contemporary history. The question was, how should we tolerate? You know, you don't know what the extent of the rebellion. So should we tolerate it? Shouldn't we tolerate it? It takes time. Until you make a decision to get together and go all out, it has to be a tremendous provocation. But to me, it makes sense. It indicates that they didn't just jump in there and put down the rebellion. Maybe they tried to pressure them by other means. It doesn't describe all the details. Maybe they negotiated with them, maybe they tried to convince them. It doesn't really go into all of these particulars. Okay? Now, in the 14th year, let's learn this. In the 14th year, they finally decided that the situation wasn't tolerable. But what was their solution to the problem? In other words, they weren't going to go back there and correct the situation. You'd think they'd go back there, put down the rebellion, and reinstate the tent. They decided it wasn't worth doing that. They decided to sort of like close the book, to put an end to the entire thing, and to remove all of the resources, the wealth of those countries. See, there's two ways you can milk the country, so to speak. One way, it's probably a better way, is not to totally destroy them, the infrastructure, the economy, and so forth. Yeah, because then you can't tax them. So basically, the objective is to allow them to continue to produce, to be productive, and take over the country. That's tax. However, once they rebel, you may decide that it's just not worth it anymore. It costs too much. It's too much trouble. So then you may decide to liquidate the enterprise. Then go in there, put an end to them, and you'll take out all the resources. So that's also wealth. The only thing is, in the long range, you see, in the immediate, in the short range picture, that's better because you get much more. But in terms of the long range, you have to weigh one factor against the other. This way, you don't have to deal with rebellion anymore. So the first solution that they imposed upon them was that of taxation. And that worked.
for 12 years. But then they began to rebel. And after, I assume after 13 years, they decided that she's not working anymore. And you make it, what? Yeah, it makes sense also, because if you're going to have to get together a coalition every time to and to mobilize and you know, get the armies together, so you might as well put an end to the... Yes, and you see that that was the objective. You see that that was the objective because they did it very systematically. That's what the Pesukim can point out much more than it has to. Because what do I have to know about all the surrounding nations? It says, Vayakul es Ephraim ba'Asdod Kanaim. They were fighting, weren't their enemy. All these other kingdoms that they defeated weren't the enemy. They weren't part of the coalition of the five. The Zuzim, the Amim, and the Chori. Then they returned to Ein Mishpat, and then they defeated the entire Sudei Amaleki and the Amori that were in Chasaton Tamar. All of these other states, or whatever they were not really the enemy. So what's the shot? Why they fight against them?
Well, they took them since they got together. They had five kings.
But they weren't part of the five.
No.
The first who say that the intelligent way to do it is that these other nations might have been supporting them, or might have been allies, or might have been a threat to them. When you come in, you launch a major attack. You want to make sure that everything is, you know, to cover your flank, so to speak, protect your flank. So. The Chumash is not giving us all the military details, but it makes sense. It's describing this to us. That, you see also from this that that was their purpose, that it wasn't just a raid, you know, to crush the rebellion, just to reinstate the old order. That was it. Then they turned their full attention, now that they had destroyed all the surrounding nations, so anybody who could possibly help them, then they turned their full attention against Saddam and the coalition of the five, and they scored a tremendous victory. Complete rout. They fell into these pits, and they seen the Saddam, and the rest ran to the mountains. So you see that it was complete, total annihilation. And they took the Kola for Saddam and Amora and all of their food, and they left. That means they didn't leave over any means of subsistence. So they took the captives, the people, and they took all of the property and all the food, complete liquidation. And then it says they took Lot and his Rechush and so forth. Alright, who Yosha is the stone? Making the point. Making a point, by the way, that the Rosh is what caused this to happen to him, which is the fact that he dwelled in stone. Yes. And Rashi also makes the point before that it said when it says Vagam Lot, Haholech Hazavim, when he's telling him this Nevi Oholom. Vagam Lot, Haholech Hazavim. The Rosh says it's the same Midora, that what caused Lot to have all this wealth, Yeshivato and Avram. In other words, he made a mistake, Lot. That the fact that he was together with Abraham was very important in terms of his perfection, also in terms of his practical success. He had stuck with Lot in a certain way. But once he left Abraham and he chose to live in Sodom, so then the Ashkacha did not relate to him that way anymore. He was taken captive. He was also taken captive. In other words, it wasn't inherent in Lot's success. A lot of the benefits in his life was due to his association with Abraham. The question that we're dealing with is, how did Abraham think that he, with his 318 men, could be successful where the coalition of five kings would be not just them, but all the other powerful nations, the Fire and the Zizim and so forth. These are powerful people. They all had been defeated. Alright? So the first thing that I think we have to say is, see, it stems from the nature of Abraham. That is to say that, Abraham, he based himself on an important ideal. And, see, emotionally, most people have this sense, this feeling of invincibility. Most armies try, they use a method of intimidation. They try to project an image of invincibility.
and that's a very powerful force. But once you're successful, once you have that aura of invincibility, so it's not just that no one is going to go out and fight against you. It's more than that. You're not even going to think about it. Like, don't even think about it. That's what they're saying. You heard the expression, like, don't even think about it. That's a very big factor in human relations, in sports, in business, in competition. You see, the Nazis, they were able to achieve tremendous victories against Poland, against France, because they had this aura. When people have this aura, and others, see, it only works on a governor who's subject to being intimidated, because he himself has this capacity to overestimate the human mind. The Avram didn't have it. Avram was not a governor who was a Bahaki of being intimidated by these types of things. Of course, he was rational. doesn't mean to say you don't have rational fear, but that irrational fear, which stems from being subject to somebody else's aura of invincibility, he wasn't subject to that. Just like Governor Norris wasn't subject to the intimidation of Goliath. He looked the situation over. He looked over rationally. Now, the truth of the matter is that that idea of invincibility is a myth. It's an emotion. It's simply not true. There is no such thing as human invincibility. There's no such thing. There's no, every human organization, every army, no matter how powerful they are, have built-in vulnerability, which is us, since they're human. And armies, you see the Nazis? Sure, were once, who were the ones that really showed the invincibility? The Jews, the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto held out longer than the entire Poland. For 42 days or something. And you read the account that they were desperate, they had no choice. They decided that they didn't think that they could last a few days. But you read the description. And the first battle, and the Nazis came in with their tanks or whatever, and they threw their Molotov cocktails, and they saw the Germans jumping out and screaming. Well, they just couldn't believe it. Like, they're human, they have fear, they're like in terror. Like, gay, that broke the whole myth. And they had tremendous courage to keep going. And in the end, they couldn't be defeated. What they wound up doing was just blowing up their building by building by building. They couldn't defeat them. You know what I'm saying? That Avraham Avinu, before he decided what to do, reviewed the situation. And in reviewing the situation, the average person wouldn't even review the situation. What, he said, are you crazy? And you just said, that's it. In other words, that image is in your mind. By the way, it can be very, very dangerous also for those who overestimate themselves. You see that happened to Israel. In 1967, they were viewed as the underdog. And they won this tremendous, tremendous victory. Then they became like the invincible ones. And to the extent that they never took seriously the Arab threat. That's one of the reasons, one of the causes why they were taken by 1776, because every assessment was based upon this idea that the Arabs would never be that crazy to attack them. You know, once the Arabs broke through that fear, they caught the Israelis by surprise. But it's dangerous both ways. But the truth of the matter is that there's no such thing as human invincibility. Every army, every king, every warrior had a weakness, which is subject to being exploited. But that doesn't mean that you'll be able to find it, and doesn't mean you'll have the capability of doing it, but you should search it. Okay. So I'm saying, let's take a look now, given all these factors. By the way, Avraham Avinu was aware of all these factors, because this is by Yavala poet, by Yageh Avraham Ibn. And when the poet came, and he was, according to the law, he was Og, and he was from the Rephaim, so he knew everything that had taken place. So I would say that Avraham Avinu basically debriefed him. He got all the information of what was going on. And what would you say then was the weakness, was the vulnerability that Avraham was able to exploit? In other words, I have to understand the state of mind. See, size by itself, by the way, size by itself, coalitions and all of that, are not necessarily a benefit. It's only besides the benefit when they're operating harmoniously and utilizing their resources properly. When you, in certain situations, it could be a liability, like in the Six-Day War. when the Egyptians filled up the entire Sinai, and then the Israelis took it out. Then when they were trying to escape from the Israelis, the very numbers became a problem. They can't move. So all of these factors, you have to understand another thing, that Avraham Avinu did not decide to go to war against the poor. That he would never do. This is, for example, let's say they would have come to Avraham before Lot was captured, when the four kings were on the way to attacking Stone. Let's say that was the case. After the initial victory, now they're going on the way to attack Sodom, and they told Avraham, would he have done the same thing then? No, because then they were aligned, then to go against them in a frontal and all-out war would be disaster. He didn't have those kind of resources. The real thing over here is that Avraham really didn't go to war against the poor. Basically, it was a raid. Now let me ask you that was a raid. For example, how many losses did Avraham sustain? How many men did he lose in this raid? Chazal on the pasuk, God said, "I'll tira Avraham, I know if you're mugging me, do not be afraid, I'll protect you." So one of the pshat, and not the plain pshat, is that he's afraid for all the nefashos to be killed. But it doesn't say the nefashos to be lost of his own men. And there's also Chazal that criticized him because they say the 318 were Talmid Chacham, so they're critical. They use Talmid Chacham to fight a war. I'm not going into the idea, but the point is that doesn't criticize him for having them killed. This is the problem. There's no indication at all, which again is very unusual in a war. But it's what I'm saying is that when the Pope came and he told him the story, he realized that he had a tremendous opportunity if he would mobilize his forces and act with speed. That's another reason why he didn't take his time to build up reserves and so on and so forth, because if that's the case, that's not what his strength was. He didn't want to fight a real war against them. But right now they were in the most vulnerable state of all. Psychologically they were totally unprepared. Psychologically. Because they thought that everything was secured. Any potential enemy had been eliminated. Didn't know there was an Avraham. Now bear in mind also the same things you must do. So it says, Vayark Echanika, that he armed them, 318 men. See, from this you have to deduce that Avraham Avinu did take measures to protect himself. That he had he didn't rely on miracles. He had a pact with Aner, Achia, Aner Eshkol, right, Mamre. He had a pact with them. And he must have trained his men to skirmishes, to defend himself. Because you see, he had weapons. Makes sense. I mean, obviously, the Chumash doesn't go into that, but he must make a deduction. Because after he armed them, he didn't have arms. And what good is army people if they don't know how to use the arm? So yeah, you have to deduce that they had trained. Because he was a small group, and he had to protect himself to whatever extent possible, and his property also, against robbers and so forth. Now, I would say that the best moment to strike was right at that point. Because you have to understand their state of mind. Psychologically they were at their weakest, because in their own minds, that's it, they've won. It's time of captivity, total victory. Soldiers are, and that's the hardest time to control them, is when they fought, they're victorious, and they're totally preoccupied with all these possessions, the women, the food, whatever. You see even in the Torah, the whole mystery of your father's Torah, that's when a person's his whole psyche is destroyed. So that is the background. That Avraham realized that, see, he wasn't, again, I'm telling you, he was not intent upon attacking the entire country. They're in a state of like demobilization. It's probably the most vulnerable state. Because they're not geared, in other words, they're not organized for fighting. They demobilized. And they haven't even gone back to a peacetime footing. Because when you go back to a peacetime footing, at least you set up guards, whatever, some type of a defense. They didn't have either one. But the army was simply on its way back, totally preoccupied, not in battle formation, totally preoccupied with the possessions, and completely